Hello everyone, my name is Vlad Glavanu. I am the head of psychology and counseling at Webster University Geneva and director of the Webster Center for Creativity and Innovation. And it is my great pleasure to have here with me Professor Alfonso Montuori from the California Institute of Integral Studies to talk today a little bit about creativity. Hello, Alfonso.
Hello, Vlad.
And welcome to Geneva.
Thank you.
I'm going to start with quite an open question because I'm really curious what you're going to answer. There's so many definitions of creativity, right? What would be your preferred way of defining creativity? Do you have a preferred way?
You know, that's a very interesting question because I think I have to say that it was, oh my God, I can't actually remember who said it, but somebody says it's like pornography. I can't define it, but I know it when I see it. And it was some famous judge, I believe, who said that. I think there are many definitions of creativity around, the obvious one being sort of the more traditional one of bringing something original and useful into the world.
Yes.
And I'm increasingly seeing creativity as a way of being in the world.
Yes.
So a way of being in the world that's open-minded, that's improvisational, that goes towards creating indifference, sees differences as an opportunity for creativity.
Excellent. So it's a much more kind of existential and humanistic in many ways, rather than just measurement-based and criteria-based. Excellent. I was actually thinking now, because I think we share a lot, obviously, I think we do. And one of the things that, to me at least personally, it's always quite interesting is the notion of creative potential. Mm-hmm. So many people and across generations, they talk about potential. And it was meant to be a notion that was kind of liberating and democratizing creativity, but it became quite static and reified. So I wonder, what are your thoughts about this notion of creative potential versus achievement, right, when you do actually something creative?
Right. I think that's a very interesting question because I think we probably both still come across a lot of people who say, well, I'm not creative.
Yes.
And I think that also has to do with your first question, the definition of creativity, in the sense that people think, well, I'm not a quantum physicist. I'm not Picasso or Van Gogh, so I'm not creative. Obviously, I think the creative potential resides in everybody in different ways. And I think this relatively new way of understanding creativity that's known as everyday creativity, I think can be helpful in making that more obvious to people. At the same time, the notion of creative potential has also, I think in some ways being a little problematic because there's a tendency to sort of take it too lightly. And I think if we start off with certain misunderstandings about creativity, then, you know, my finger painting becomes artistic genius all of a sudden. Mm-hmm. And we're all sort of great creators. And I think there's an issue of creativity, and there's an issue of being really good at an art.
so being kind of a masterful creator versus creator by accident, although they both kind of fit into each other, but you need to recognize expertise and recognize, right?
Absolutely. The work. I mean, I think if you're going to be an artist, then there are there are skills that you need to develop. To participate in that world, and that's left out. And one of the reasons why I'm interested in history, we've talked about this before, is because I think a lot of the misunderstandings about creativity date back to a certain sort of romantic picture of creativity that emerged very strongly with Romanticism, but has been around for a long time and was around before that. This idea that genius is a gift from God. So the whole idea of a person being gifted, I think, tells us something there. And also that the genius didn't, the idea of genius without learning.
Yes.
What differentiates the genius is that the genius doesn't have to study, doesn't have to work hard, that it just is this thing that flows from the gifted individual. And I think people still sort of see that, in the sense that very often I see people dichotomizing, splitting between creative brilliance and hard work.
Yeah.
And of course, people who are really brilliant at something work very hard
for
it.
Work.
But interestingly, there's also that saying, don't let them see you sweat, right, in the art. So don't.
But it's interesting because we also talked about culture, and I will ask you more about this because I know you've traveled to China, you traveled probably to many more places, and it's so shocking to see in some ways the difference of how people recognize tradition and mastery and right. Mm-hmm. I mean, do you see it as quite a Western phenomenon to always want to be seeming very casual about what you do? Because I to be honest, I'm not an expert in necessarily Eastern conceptions of creativity. I know that if you look at calligraphy and many, many types of art, which have also European roots or expressions, but there is the idea of seeming, you know, kind of seamless doing, performing. So what would you say about this East-West? I don't want to dichotomize again too much, but this cultural variation in conceptions of creativity.
Yeah, I mean, in Italy, there's the term sprezzatura, right? Which is also this sort of the ability to create in a very kind of nonchalant way, right?
Yes.
And I mean, what I've found interesting in Chinese art, for instance, is the repetition of certain very basic themes and ways of painting, for instance.
Yes.
So certain forms that appear to be relatively static, and there isn't that rush to create new genres and things like that. Yeah, but the creativity manifests itself in a different kind of way, right? Because it's not that these works are not creative, but they manifest in a different way, even as, I mean, people used to say that, you know, Japan is not a very creative culture, for instance, you know, and that in terms of innovation, that the West was always ahead. But the Japanese innovate in very interesting and different ways.
Yes.
And so there was a lot of focus on process innovation rather than new product generation, right? So it's...
Exactly. And nowadays, the economy is, well, it's been doing well. It's been static at times, but it definitely, you're right, that it's interesting, the mixture of conceptions and ideologies of creativity, because I, seeing some work done in by colleagues working in these other cultural spaces, I feel sometimes sorry that I feel they appropriate the standard definition instead of thinking through their own cultural kind of lenses and experience what creativity could be often. But you also have another very interesting part of your expertise, is that you approach creativity not only in terms of you looked at different cultures in many ways, but different disciplines, right? How would you identify your own approach to creativity? Would you even ground it within a certain discipline, or what would you name it,
Alfonso? Yeah, well, I think of my approach as being transdisciplinary.
Yes.
And of course, I draw a lot from psychology, because psychology has historically been what I call sort of the dominant disciplinary discourse. In other words, 20, 30 years ago, if you wanted to find out where most of the writing on creativity, most of the research was done, it was in psychology. There was a little bit done in sociology, anthropology, but really psychology was where it's at. And, you know, some of my inspirations came from people in that field. But I found that the kinds of questions that I was interested in were often not being addressed. Yes. And so that there was something about sort of disciplinary boundaries that prevented certain questions from being asked.
Yeah.
And that's when I thought, well, I need to broaden things out here and draw on different disciplines to understand what's going on. Because, you know, obviously one of my... the first interests was I played in a band, and I still perform, and I still think, you know, one of my own personally, the most interesting creative experiences have been performing in a group. But in the 80s, there was hardly anything about that. And then I became interested in why that was happening. Mm-hmm. And a lot of it had to do, I think, that creativity, the dominant disciplinary discourse was psychology.
Yes.
And psychologists just were not that interested in all that.
Yeah, the group dynamic. At the time, of course, it has different expressions. Some of them, sadly, they call themselves group, but they look at individual within the group
right,
much more.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
And what would a transdisciplinary approach to creativity? Of course, I know a bit more about it, but for those who listen to us and might wonder, what kind of questions or what kind of frameworks does it operate with? What would be its guiding principles?
Well, I can give you an example, one that you know, which is sort of understanding the relationship of women and creativity.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's been sort of a cultural sense that generally men are more creative than mm-hmm. women, and certainly that geniuses have come mostly or almost entirely from men. I was interested how do you understand that, and can you then address that question if all you do is look at individuals and you don't look at their social context?
Yes.
Because women were simply not allowed to participate in the domains in which people could be recognized as geniuses. Well, once you've said that, then you need to mm-hmm. study a lot of other dimensions in order to make sense of the phenomenon. And also one which I think is relevant in terms of the whole notion of a more social creativity is, how can we create environments that foster creativity?
Yes.
Right? And again, I think that requires looking at the individual, but at relationships, at larger social contexts, and so on. So I think there's a lot that opens up once you take away that border around the individual and start looking more broadly.
So basically, a transdisciplinary approach is kind of more comprehensive and contextualizing much more, because I can see how it brings points of focus that isolated. I mean, psychology is one point of focus and it has its own preferred unit, which sadly often is kind of reduced to the mind, the individual. Mm-hmm. But there are different ways of doing psychology. Right. Like, there are many different ways of doing discipline, the other stuff. But if you put them together, then you have a more complete image, right? Of
exactly,
what it means to
exactly. And then, for instance, in the case of creativity in women, you can see how historically they were blocked from participating and, you know, in many ways still are, and oddly enough, in places like Silicon Valley. Mm-hmm. And that has a real impact. And I think in order to understand creativity, particularly now that we are in a more networked society, we need to do the kind of work that you're doing, because you've really been, a leader in opening up our understanding of creativity and taking it away from this sort of limited unit of analysis that's been common in the traditional discourse. So, I think the kind of work that you've been doing has been very important.
Thank
because
you so
it's,
much.
Yeah, no, I mean, seriously.
I feel like I often say this when I talk about my orientation, which we share. It's kind of our orientation that I'm not anti-individual, and I'm anti-individualism, which is something you talked about a lot in your work about reductionism and the dangers of reducing. And it's a lot about units of analysis. What is your unit?
Exactly.
If you cut it, I mean, you have to work with a unit of analysis, just that the way you decide for it has so many premises packed into it. And then you can't be surprised about your findings later on when they are partial.
Right. And the problem, I think, is when the partial understanding is presented as the whole.
Exactly.
Sorry to interrupt you, but that's...
I agree. And you also, in your academic trajectory, you covered so many topics in relation to creativity. Transdisciplinarity is one of them. Then we talked about inquiry this morning. Then there is the whole complexity idea, right? How do these points of interest sit near each other? If you want to say a bit more about how they connect to creativity, complexity, inquiry... and creativity.
Yeah. So the complexity dimension is because I've been very influenced by the work of Edgar Morin, and his focus has been on developing a way to understand the world that does not, that is not reductive or just disjunctive in the sense of either or, but that allows us to study sort of the interwoven complex coming from complex as interwoven, right? Yeah. The world as interwoven, interconnected, and interdependent. And so how do you do that? And so his work has been on articulating what he calls complex thought, which is directly related to transdisciplinarity. So how do you understand the world, not as these isolated atoms, but as interconnected? And so that's been key for me. And also in terms of education and inquiry, I had a terrible experience in primary school in the sense that I was very, very lucky, and I had an incredible teacher for 2 years who made learning fun, and I'm still in touch with some of my classmates, and we still sort of wax lyrically about him just because he made everything so much fun and so exciting, and he made learning a joy. But then, of course, after that, I had 15 years or so of misery because I knew it could be different, right?
Yeah, maybe that was the problem.
I knew it didn't have to be the way they were doing, they were teaching. So that's why I came back to that. And in a way, in the PhD, I found the perfect opening because a PhD dissertation is technically an original contribution to a field. So the minute you say that it's an original contribution, that means creativity is involved. Yes. So education then can be framed as a creative process.
Yeah.
And so I started thinking, well, what would it be like to put a degree together that really focused on that? That where the focus is not on the study of creativity, but framing inquiry as a creative process.
Yeah.
And I've had a lot of fun with that. And of course, working with it as a degree, I've also seen, you know, how hard it is to get these ideas across, how I need to be clearer about a lot of things, because there are also a lot of assumptions about creativity, like the genius without learning, like the, oh, but I'm not creative. And also, what does creativity have to do with social science, right? Because people assume, well, you just use some kind of method, you find things, and that it's just sort of a very rote kind of process.
Yes. Sadly, these kind of misconceptions are quite dangerous on all sides, including for how young scientists or scientists generally think of their mission and the way they build an identity in relation to what they do, right?
Right.
We need creative social science. We need creative societies.
Definitely. And I think we also need for scientists to communicate creatively and collaboratively, which is something that doesn't always happen, as you know. I mean, we've both, I'm sure, been in situations where we've seen academic discourse sort of turn into taking pot shots at each other. Or, I mean, one of the things that I see often is that intelligence is often defined as the ability to critique somebody else and, you know, destroy somebody's argument, because that shows, you know, how clever we are and how we could see problems and faults. And of course, that's necessary to be able to think that way. But if that's the dominant way, that's not interesting anymore.
Exactly. Deconstruction is a particular move of creativity, but it needs to be complemented. Right. It can't be left at the pieces.
Exactly.
To then make something with it.
Yeah.
A lot of your work also focused on the future, and you contribute a lot to this domain, and it seems so intrinsically connected to creativity. But if you can say a few words about why the future and what is there in the future? How can we approach the future?
Right. What is the future? That's a good question. I've always been interested in it, I think. And one of the things that I'm increasingly noticing is that, you know, words that were still around when I was growing up, like progress, or this idea of don't stand in the way of progress, now those very things we weren't supposed to stand in the mm-hmm. way of are seen as polluting or dangerous. So there's this skepticism about science, skepticism about progress. People don't use the word anymore.
Yes.
And I'm also fascinated by seeing images of the future, say from the turn of the century,
mm-hmm.
There because they're so oriented towards technology. And you yes. see women still have the same roles in the kitchen, only that their kitchen is, you know, beautifully yeah. space age, and you hardly see any nature. It's mm-hmm. all scientific wonders of, you know, people going around in jetpacks and things like that. Yeah. And so I'm fascinated about, particularly now, how can we think about the future in a way that isn't utopian, but that is realistic and is a better future? Because my mm-hmm. concern is young people growing up today in a context where there is nothing to look forward to in a way.
Yeah, or no alternatives to imagine in some ways. I mean, we are guided in a very linear way, and in the way education is done, going back to what you mentioned, with less inquiry and less critical thinking,
right?
It's just taking it for granted that things have to be that way, the way they are, basically.
Yeah, yeah. And so for me, this is all about, well, how can we get people to think together about what they think, what they would like the future to be like? Because I think, I don't think we ask that of ourselves and of young people. What would we like? What would a better future look like?
Well, nowadays, of course, we're talking within a political kind of climate that brings these questions to the front, but mm-hmm. also brings all the other concerns. And because you worked on future and you look at technology and the way we think of it, I often find myself lamenting with myself and others about the big promise of interconnectedness and the failure in many ways. Of course, we cannot throw the baby in the bathwater, you know, the dirty bathwater. I do think personally that being so connected today makes a difference in our lives. You look at how students, children look for information today.
Yeah.
I mean, you're right. But then comes the information bubbles, there comes the isolation, there
right.
comes even kind of becoming more entrenched in your own perspective. What would be your reflections on that, Alfonso? I'm sure there some of these questions are on your mind too.
Yeah, no, that's a great question.
Where do we go wrong?
Right, that's a great question. I mean, I think we've gone through an incredible transition so fast. When I moved to the U.S. in 83, I had a little address book with me with all my friends' names in it. But if I lost that address book, or if one of my friends moved, and that was a friend that wasn't in touch with my other friends, that was it, right? And the first time I called my parents to say I'm here, I spent about half an hour on the phone with them, and it cost me $100, which in 1983 was a lot of money,
wow.
certainly for a student, right?
Yes.
Now, we can Skype for free, and we can just stay in touch with all of our friends. And so things have changed so rapidly. I don't think we've sort of wrapped our heads around it.
Yeah.
And it's
yeah.
still like we have all these new toys and are trying to make sense of them.
Yeah.
I think it does need a lot of discernment, though, because, I mean, you know, I'm in Europe for a month. My wife is in the U.S., I can, in real time, take a quick picture of what I'm eating and send it to her.
Yeah,
And so we can chat and just stay in touch a little bit. And of course, I've taught online for 23 years now. I've really only taught online, and I think it's got great possibilities. But then my classes are always between 12 and 15 people. They're not classes of thousands of people. So there are many different ways in which you can do all that. And none of this came with a manual.
Yes.
Really.
And it's in this kind of gap or tension between how our lives used to be, what are prepared, what our expectations are, right? And
right.
and how things are, that
yeah.
good things and bad things come out.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I noticed, though, that I've been interested in the systems approach, complexity, these kinds of ways of thinking. And I know that 20, 30 years ago, there was a lot of resistance against all that, against the idea of social creativity. People would say, oh, it's an oxymoron. It's socialist or communist, which in the U.S. wasn't, 30 years ago, wasn't such a great thing. You know, I think things are changing in that sense, in a way that is much more open to interconnectedness, much more open to systemic kind of thinking, because we live in a networked society.
Yes.
And that makes a big difference. And of course, my own interest also in the way that creativity is showing up in young people. And I think they are not only open to the idea of social creativity in the way that their parents weren't, but when I think they get to express how they view creativity, they see it as a much more everyday, relational, what you would call a distributed process, more of a we paradigm rather than a, you know, there's the lone genius, or, you know, I'm wonderfully creative. But it's more like a relational approach, which I think is actually, it's interesting. You know, I make that difference between Woodstock, where, you know, thousands of people go see their, roll around in the mud to see, you know, Jimi Hendrix and all their stars, and roll around in the mud, and Burning Man. Right? Mm. Burning Man, there's a breakdown of that audience and star dualism. And at Burning Man, everybody's a star. Everybody dresses up. Everybody does, different outrageous things. But and they do them together in camps, creating temples and things like that. So it's much more relational, everyday creativity in a way. And I think that's an exciting development.
So it's kind of a paradigm shift in many ways. I mean, we kind of propose that this is how creativity always happens, is that the dynamic is obscured ideologically very often by things. And now maybe we're realigning because of all of this technology, mix and match culture and things like that.
Yeah.
The last question is a bit more personal, because I know that you've played jazz. You're married to a well-known jazz singer. How did that fit into your interest, your view of creativity? I can definitely see clear links. But if you reflect back, was that like a determining factor? Or do you keep the two together, like the way you think of creativity and what you might do when you play?
No, I mean, they're very much connected for me. And I think all of my research topics have all sort of been inspired by my own personal experiences, which then lead me to inquire about something. Yes. And certainly my experience with music and my experience with my wife has led to all sorts of different kinds of reflections, because as a singer, my wife leads her band. And so I get to see a woman leader in action. And at the same time, how she would frame the creative process of the band, which for her is very improvisational. But no, it's really been a very rich experience for me, and also continued my interest in improvisation, because I think that's a very interesting topic. And improvisation is very often thought of in terms of jazz, but the whole history of Western classical music was full of improvisation. Mm-hmm. And of course, it wasn't recorded, right? Because we didn't have the tools. But people like Beethoven and Bach were known as great improvisers. And at a certain point, that kind of disappeared from the Western tradition. So there's just so much, I think, that's exciting, and it's worth researching there. So
absolutely. Yeah. And clear parallels with all the topics, basically, we touched upon.
Right, right.
Excellent. Thank you so much, Alfonso.
Thank you, Vlad.
This has been Professor Alfonso Montuori from the California Institute of Integral Studies in dialogue with me, Vlad Glavanu, and part of the lecture series, the podcast series associated with the Webster Center for Creativity and Innovation. If you want to listen to more of our podcasts, please go to podcast.webster.ch. Thank you again.